The Drunk Shopping Survey from Finder.com shows online shopping while drunk may cost consumers as much as $40 billion a year. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. 2,000 American adults were surveyed about boozed buying. A little more than a quarter of Americans shop while drunk, and the amount being spent is rising. Have you ever bought anything online while inebriated? What did you buy? Did you regret it later? After a night of drinking, do you ever notice a significant dent in your bank account? And I don't mean your bar bill. Do you have trouble remembering what you bought? Join our conversation at 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Keith Ponywaz is with us this morning. He's the Director of International Advisory Services and a Financial Advisor with Walkner Condon Financial Advisors in Madison. Keith, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
We seem to be in a culture where we drink, we click around online, we put an unnecessary item in our cart, and then we buy it. Why is it when we're under the influence, our spending habits change?
Well, I think it's a function of how shopping works in general. When you're at the store, they put candy bars right by the store, by the checkout there, and you are tempted to buy that. And then drinking lowers our inhibitions, and now whenever we're at home, buying that candy bar is now a click away. And with the prevalence of online shopping, the mistakes get more expensive than just a candy bar.
The Drunk Shopping Survey says that in 2019, the average American will spend $736 on items while under the influence. That sounds like an awful lot. Which generation do you think is more likely to make these drunk purchases?
Well, one of the things when you look at the survey that gets spent on a lot are food orders online. And so what will frequently happen, and I think, you know, many people in Wisconsin may be familiar with this, is you go out after work for happy hour, you get home, you're hungry, and you click on an app or something like that to buy yourself some food. So I think that might be a more common experience. But in our work, what we see is generally that this tends to occur more with people who are a little younger and a little more internet friendly in terms of food orders. Some of the other orders, there might be a mom at home who has a couple of glasses of wine and goes and shops for the kids. So there are a variety, but it'll depend on the nature of the spending.
The people who admit to making drunk purchases, according to the survey, 44% are women, 56% are men. What's the difference here, do you think?
I think whenever we talk about spending money, you talk about sort of psychological issues, right? And when alcohol lowers inhibitions. So it may be that men are, have a harder time spending money during the regular course of the day. I also think, the in terms of shopping for food, that tends to be a little more on the male side in terms of, buying takeout or delivery online.
And how would you describe the attitude of online shoppers in the survey who spent more money after or while drinking? Do you think these shoppers are spenders or savers?
You never really know, right? Because people might be savers in their everyday life. They may feel pressure about saving, and then they have a few drinks, and they, let loose once they've had a few drinks and spend money that way. So I think people can be both spenders and savers in this case.
Keith Ponywaz is the Director of International Advisory Services and a Financial Advisor with Walkner Condon Financial Advisors in Madison. We're talking about online shopping while under the influence. After a night of drinking, do you ever notice a significant dent in your bank account or a purchase you can't remember making? Give us a call and tell us your story at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email address is ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. The Finder.com survey revealed our top drunken purchases, as you mentioned, were food, followed by shoes and clothing. So why do you think these items in particular are the most common to purchase?
Well, I think part of it is laziness. That accounts for the food thing. Many of us, will have food in at home, and whether we're drunk or sober, think, it's been a long day. I've worked hard. I deserve to have takeout and or delivery. And so that, I think, accounts for it. And then when you add in the factor of drinking, that makes it even easier to justify to yourself to that kind of laziness. In terms of shoes and food, I think clothing, these are items that people crave. And, you know, many of us know in our rational mind when we're sober, I don't need another pair of shoes. I don't need another polo shirt. I don't need another belt, whatever it might be. But then we see that pair when we're scrolling around and we've had a few drinks and we say to ourselves, okay, you know what? I really deserve that pair of shoes. And so I think in, you know, talking to folks around the community and, you know, even our clients, that lowering of inhibitions are why we see that those purchases for things that maybe we already have plenty of as individuals, as a society. But once we lower those inhibitions, boom, people are willing to pull the trigger on that.
Well, talk about some other maybe regrettable purchases your clients might have made while under the influence or even while sober.
Well, the number one thing that people regret in terms of purchases, drunk, sober, whenever, are boats. And I think, you know, being in Madison, this is the dream of the lakes here. People see the fun they have with a boat, and, you know, they think about how great it would be to take the family out or whatever. And then you start factoring in, you know, all the costs and the maintenance and the getting it to the lake and getting it in the water and all of that, and they enjoy it a lot less. And, you know, it's one of the things that shocked me about that Finder.com survey was that up to 10% of Americans have purchased something major like a car or a vacation or even a boat online while drunk. And so, you know, I think it's that lowering of inhibitions and that dream that happens when we drink.
Well, it's one thing for our inhibitions to be lowered. It's another thing to have the convenience of being able to make purchases like boats and cars directly from your phone. In my generation growing up, that if you wanted to make a drunk purchase, you actually had to go somewhere. And chances are the stores weren't open at that hour anyway. Now, you know, with a couple of taps from your thumb on your phone, you're the proud owner of a BMW or something.
Yeah, it's really amazing, isn't it? And, you know, in many cases, you can make huge purchases with just one click, depending on what, you know, app or program that you're using. You know, your credit card is already entered. You push a button and, you know, you can spend thousands and thousands of dollars just like that.
Yeah. Online retailers do store our credit card information, and that's what makes that one-click checkout so convenient. And we think at the time, oh, yeah, great, I don't want to have to make that extra decision, but maybe it would be a good idea not to store that info and force yourself to actually have to get out your wallet before you make that purchase. We're talking about drunk buying, boozed buying, inebriated purchases. What do you do? Have you made a purchase while intoxicated? Did you remember making it when you saw it show up on your credit card statement and when the package arrived at your door? Or was it you were a little under the weather, you didn't feel like cooking, and you ordered some delivery? Keith Ponywaz is the Director of International Advisory Services and a financial advisor with Walker Condon Financial Advisors in Madison. We'll continue our conversation about drunk shopping in a moment, and we'll take your calls at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent, completely sober. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. Clothes, boats, cars, and food. The sky's the limit for online purchases when you're intoxicated. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. The amount of money Americans spend while shopping while under the influence jumped by almost $10 billion in the last year. tipsy Wisconsin consumers spend anywhere from $400 to $500 a year. That's according to the 2019 Drunk Shopping Survey on Finder.com. Do you enjoy sitting at home with a glass of wine or two and shopping online? Have you ever stopped yourself from buying something you didn't need? Well, what did you almost buy? And have you ever spent too much while shopping online? Do you think shopping websites just make it too easy for us? Share your story at 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Keith Poniewoz is continuing our conversation with us about this issue. He's the Director of International Advisory Services and Financial Advisor with Wachner Condon Financial Advisors in Madison. Let's go to the phones. Marcus is with us from Milwaukee. Marcus, good morning.
Good morning, John. So I had a situation where I came home a little intoxicated on a weekend, and I started looking at stuff on eBay, and I had some stuff in my wish list, and I accidentally ended up clicking on a buy now for an $89 Ellis Dirt micrometer.
And was that something you needed, or was that just something you wanted?
A little bit of both. I do remodeling and construction, so it was of use. I didn't need it at that moment.
Yeah. So, and did you remember making that purchase later when it showed up?
No, because I literally passed out on the computer and just hit it with my cheek or something. I don't know.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Marcus, thanks for sharing your story. Keith, how common is Marcus's story here?
Probably more common than we think. I had an acquaintance who was watching basketball. And he hadn't shot in hoops in a long period of time, was watching the NCAA basketball tournament, thought, you know what, I haven't shot hoops in a while, and ended up, you know, a couple of days later getting a basketball. Fortunately, he was, you know, able to, you know, recreate the thought process, but I think it happens with some frequency.
Well, at least he only bought a basketball. He didn't buy, a gymnasium or something.
Now with one-click ordering, it's possible that you probably could get...
I suppose you could. Yeah. 800-642-1234. Marcus, thanks for your call. The Drunk Shopping Survey revealed that of 2,000 people surveyed, 12% bought a pet, 14% bought a vacation, 10% bought a car. This might sound a bit humorous, but we're really not trying to make fun of this. This is a serious issue. Why should we be concerned about shopping online while a little bit under the weather?
Well, I think, first of all, from a personal perspective, it affects our finances day to day, week to week, month to month. If many people are in a position where they may not be able to afford this $100 purchase or $20 purchase. And the other thing that we forget about in a lot of cases, and I'm the child of two accountants, so I do this sort of naturally, is we don't think of annualizing or, you know, multiplying out all of these expenses. So if, you know, we come home a little tipsy, and instead of making dinner at home, we order in, you end up with $25, $30 extra. You do that once a week for 52 weeks. That adds up, and that will destroy a budget, and maybe, you know, something that you had had for an emergency fund to help protect you in the long run is now spent on, you know, food throughout the year that you didn't really need or you didn't really want. So I think from that perspective, that's one of the big concerns, is that these inadvertent purchases add up over time and, you know, end up reducing our overall wealth. The other thing is, I think as a society, it may be a reflection, and here in Wisconsin, and I know this is the focus this week, it may be a reflection of our bigger problem with alcohol and alcohol consumption, in that we now have another way that we can damage ourselves by drinking.
So what can we do about this? I mean, I guess the obvious thing is, don't drink and shop, but that seems a little bit too glib. What do we really need to do what do we need to change to fix this?
Well, before the break, I think you mentioned one of the things that, makes a lot of sense and is very easy to do is make it harder for yourself to make these purchases. So take off things like one-click shopping. Maybe don't store your credit card information in the computer. Maybe make sure that you have to re-enter everything at every point. From a larger perspective, maybe even if it's a real problem and you do it on your phone or things like that, maybe you need to delete apps from your phone. You know, don't have those food delivery apps on your phone. Delete them. Make it really hard for yourself to not indulge.
Let's take another call here. Brad is with us, also from Milwaukee. Brad, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. How are you guys?
We're doing well. So what's your story?
So my story is it's very simple, and basically I'm not an online shopper, but my wife is, and she does not drink ever. However, I do. You know, I come home and I'll have a couple glasses of wine in particular, and there are instances several times when she's asked, hey, do you need anything? So she can hit the you know, number X, Y, or Z for free shipping. And I'll give her a couple of options, and she writes them down, and then she will have me double-check the list in the morning, and then she'll submit the order.
So you wait till the next day to make the purchase, in other words, instead of just doing it right at the time.
Exactly. And that's on her. That's her foresight of being responsible, because she knows I might say something that's kind of silly or that I don't really need. And so she basically forces me to double check it.
You know, Keith, that's good advice for any kind of shopping. My mother, you always used to tell me, look at the item five times before you actually buy it, just to make sure you're serious.
Well, and it's the old saw of don't go grocery shopping hungry, right, as well. So I think, you know, any time you can put a barrier in, and I think in Brad's case, you know, what his wife is doing is very smart, is, okay, you know, here, what do you need? Let's double check this again, make sure that we need and want it.
Keith Ponywaz is the Director of International Advisory Services and a financial advisor with Wachner Condon Financial Advisors in Madison. Do you change your spending habits after you've started to drink? And how much more do you spend and where do you spend it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Brian next in Rochester, Minnesota. Brian, good morning.
Good morning, and one of the most interesting topics I've heard in a long time. Thank you for taking my call. Say, one thing, even though I agree with everything that the guest says, but one thing to put a little spin on it is that I've made a purchase, maybe two, but for sure one, where I probably, you know, because alcohol lowers the inhibitors, I probably wouldn't have made the purchase. However, after a beer or two, making the purchase and thinking, you know, after getting the product, I'm really glad I did because, you know, like, for instance, this old antiquated whatever it was I would have bought, you know, this vintage purchase. I probably wouldn't have bought it had I not had the cocktail. But I do agree with everything that the guest says.
So Brian says, yeah, I've made some purchases, but it was actually something I really wanted, and I don't regret it. But I might not have made it if I hadn't been. Had my inhibitions lowered. I suppose there's that too.
Well, and I think, you know, it speaks to our attitudes about money. Some of us naturally every day, either, you know, because of our family background or whatnot, tend to be savers, you know, tight, mm-hmm. not spend a lot of money, and then lower that inhibition and something that we really wanted but had been telling ourselves that we don't need or don't want, you know, can make its way into our cart and into our house.
Keith, are these online stores doing anything to help people avoid shopping online while drunk?
Not that I've seen, and not that we've seen in the financial press. I think, you know, in a lot of ways, they're, you know, another client to be, you know, another consumer.
Caveat emptor, I suppose, would be the Latin here. It would be hard to police that, though, too. I mean, how does Amazon know what your mental state is when you're clicking buy?
You know, there might be a sobriety check that you could put in, or you know, a breathalyzer on the computer, I think, might be a bit excessive. But yeah, you're absolutely right. How do you balance this sort of freedom with what you said there, you know, the need to constrict the spending.
And finally, if we find ourselves in a pile of debt from online shopping or of any kind, what's the first step we can take to maybe fix those poor spending habits in the future?
Well, you know, the biggest thing is to stop the spending either by eliminating the apps or the websites. If we're in debt because we're drunken shopping, people might want to take a look at, you know, their drinking habits, quite frankly, and reevaluate those. And they might need to have a conversation with themselves about their drinking. The final thing then is to start paying off the highest interest rate items first. So credit cards.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, Keith, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Keith Ponywaz is Director of International Advisory Services and a financial advisor with Walker Condon Financial Advisors in Madison. Coming up, Wisconsin's alcohol laws are complicated, to say the least. In our series, High Tolerance, we consider the politics of alcohol. That's right after the news. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. The laws that regulate alcohol in Wisconsin are complicated and confusing, partly because they've been filled with exceptions and protections for industries and businesses over the course of decades. That's created an often adversarial relationship between members of the alcohol lobby at the state capitol. In our continuing series, High Tolerance, Sean Johnson has this report on the politics of alcohol and how it's changing.
In 2011, Republican State Senator Alberta Darling introduced a sweeping proposal to rewrite beer distribution laws. 6 minutes later, she asked for a vote. It was during deliberations of the legislature's budget committee. Democratic Senator Bob Jauch stopped the roll call, still unsure of what was in the motion.
It is a little difficult when you have a nine-page document that didn't come up at any of the public hearings. But then it wouldn't be a budget without having something to do with liquor wholesalers or beer wholesalers. And it is every budget.
It's Wisconsin.
The measure was being pushed by Wisconsin's beer distributors and Miller Coors. They said it would keep Anheuser-Busch from buying up beer distributors. Small brewers wanted that power for themselves, but they weren't there to protest. And after a few minutes of discussion, the measure passed on a bipartisan vote. Longtime alcohol regulator Roger Johnson saw votes like these over and over again during his nearly four decades at the Wisconsin Department of Revenue.
I think the thing that comes to mind is that old saying I would have is that, if we can't feather our own nest, let's fence in the competition. And that's kind of the way it was.
Before he retired in 2014, Johnson was known in the industry as the state's point person for explaining what the alcohol laws actually meant and how they'd be enforced. The constant fighting among different factions of the industry reminded Johnson of the All-Star Wrestling show he watched as a kid, when 25 wrestlers would enter the ring and only one would emerge.
We were, in my role, kind of the referee in that battle royal.
One of the heavy hitters in that battle is the state's distributor lobby, the businesses that deliver Wisconsin's beer, wine, and liquor. According to a review by the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, distributors have given Wisconsin political candidates about $3.3 million over the past 20 years. Wisconsin Democracy Campaign Director Matt Rothschild says that puts them in the top 5% of all special interest donors.
They know how to play the power game. So if Democrats are in power, they're going to give more money to Democrats. If Republicans are in power, they're going to give more money to Republicans.
Another major player at the Capitol is the Tavern League of Wisconsin. Rhinelander Republican Assemblyman Rob Swearingen led the group before he was elected in 2012. He says the power of the Tavern League is in its 5,000 members.
Because every one of these lawmakers has a tavern in their backyard, or a supper club, or a reception hall, or somebody that's got a liquor license.
It used to be that when the Tavern League and the distributors teamed up, they'd usually get what they want. But that hasn't been the case recently. The two groups have been frustrated with inconsistent enforcement of liquor laws by the Department of Revenue since Roger Johnson left. They supported plans to step up enforcement by creating a so-called alcohol czar and by regulating wedding barns that allow unlicensed alcohol sales. But both efforts were blocked by a new coalition that included free market conservative groups like Americans for Prosperity and the craft beverage industry. Jeffrey Glazer is an attorney who represents craft brewers. He says that as they've spread all over the state, they've gained grassroots power too.
Because almost every single state representative and certainly every single state senator has a brewery in their district. And those breweries are very popular.
Isaac Shawaki, who started Octopi Brewing in Wanakee in 2014, says smaller businesses have come into their own since that 2011 budget.
You know, as brewers, we're small, we're scrappy, and we tended to be disorganized. I don't think we're disorganized anymore.
Some members of the alcohol industry downplay the conflict. They say brewers, distributors, and tavern owners can work together at the Capitol. But if they're passing fewer big bills these days, it could be because the battle royale over alcohol laws is no longer such a lopsided fight. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more about this story and see the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Middlescence. Well, think of it as being adolescence, maybe without the pimples and with a bit more wisdom. But is it a real thing? What about the so-called midlife crisis? This morning, we take a look at the myths surrounding our middle years and try to separate fact from fiction. Are you in your middle years? How does that compare to your adolescence? Do you take issue with terms like midlife crisis? Why? What negative associations do you think the word middle carries? Did you go through a period of significant change and growth in your midlife? Would you categorize it as a crisis, or have you always been growing and learning and it just continued into those years? Do you think we overgeneralize generations and age groups? Tell us your story. Give us your thoughts at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Susan Krause-Whitborn is Professor Emerita of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She is the author of the Psychology Today blog Fulfillment at Any Age and has conducted research in the area of personality and aging. Susan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, John. Nice to be here.
First of all, tell us about this new term, middlescence. What does it mean and why is it becoming popular?
It was coined as sort of an alternative to the quote-unquote midlife crisis, and I'm glad you raised that question about midlife crisis, but it's intended to normalize the experience of midlife and help people understand the changes they're going through. It does have a kind of connotation of a second adolescence and refers not only to whatever's going on in your life, psychologically, socially, et cetera, but also hormonally. And I think that's what the inspiration for the term came from.
Well, did we used to call this a second childhood? Have we always used midlife crisis?
Yes. I mean, second childhood comes up in a lot of different ways. I mean, you can even find it in Shakespeare talking about old age. And it's an unfortunate concept because development always moves forward. It doesn't go back. And even if you're going through a period of life where you're trying to have fun and relive your youth, so to speak, you still have bills to pay, you have a family, you have a job to go to. It's never going to be like childhood, even though in your fantasy it might be fun to feel that way for even temporarily.
So the term middlescence, is this a more positive way to say middle-aged or midlife crisis? And is the word middle problematic?
Yes. Okay. Everything there, if we unpack that, everything there is questionable. I think it was just a term, and the person who invented this term was on CBS This Morning, which is where I got the idea for writing my blog about this, and underneath the interview with her, it's scrolled the Wonder Years. All right, so I thought that was interesting. But the middle, what is the middle? I mean, if you're 60 and you're saying you're in midlife, well, then you're a terrific optimist because you're going to live to 120.
Yeah.
So it's just used as a kind of a broad term. It covers an entire swath of life. In this case, the term was intended to refer to people 40 to 65. Now, again, the 65-year-olds are optimists, but it just doesn't make sense that you lump everybody together like that and say they're going through the exact same experience.
You know, when you said Wonder Years, I was thinking, yeah, I wonder where I put my glasses, my car keys, my phone. Yeah, there's a lot of wonder. A more common term or idea around middle age, we talked about this, mentioned it earlier, the midlife crisis, referring to a negative experience or time of turmoil in our middle years. I don't know, you buy a red sports car. What are people talking about here? What are they pointing to when they say this?
The red sports car. excuse to go out and be naughty and leave everything behind and go, you know, the old image of running off to Santa Fe or, some sort of retreat in a hut. But the original idea wasn't bad. I think the idea that in your middle years, whatever that is, when you feel you're, okay, I've gone this far, you stop and wonder, question about where life is going, are you doing things the way you expected you would? I mean, there's nothing wrong with a period of a reevaluation of your priorities. You can do that on a not continuous basis because there has to be some solidity, but you can do that every so often and make some adjustments, you know, tweak. But somehow the crisis caught on because everybody likes disasters. We don't really like to be in one, but everyone's fascinated with disasters. So by calling it a crisis, it then attracted all this sort of hullabaloo and became concretized in our modern everyday parlance.
So maybe what we need to do is rebrand the middle years somehow so that we eliminate the word crisis. We can call it a reevaluation or something.
I wouldn't even call it the middle years. Again, you don't know your middle until you're at the end when you're dying, and that's going to be the last thing on your mind. But there's no need. I mean, there's no need to kind of throw generational labels onto things or decade labels onto things the way that we do. Development is continuous. Age, they say, is just a number. But if you let that number define you, however you do that, it's going to be limiting and not allow you to kind of live your life free to make your own choices and deal with problems as they arise.
Susan Krause-Whitmorn is an author and professor of psychology. Our conversation about middle age, or whatever we want to call it, will continue in a moment. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. What do you think? Do we need to rebrand those years between 40 and 65? Is there a better term we can use than middle-aged? Give us a call. Let us know. 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer-Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about so-called middle age with Susan Krause-Whitmorn, author and professor of psychology. Do you think we overgeneralize generations and age groups, or do you see distinct characteristics or experiences of people in those categories? Do you think the idea of a midlife crisis is overemphasized, or is it just an experience for the privileged? 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the conversation. 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So why is it, Susan, that we are so attached to this idea of a midlife crisis? Why won't we let it go, even when science shows us there's very little to back it up?
Well, it's one of those ideas that just won't go away because even as the adult developmental psychologists like myself and my colleagues write articles, do research, you know, write my blog based on research, every time we try to kind of smash it down a little bit, it's like a whack-a-mole, and it keeps coming back because someone else comes up with their own redefinition. So I think that's one of the reasons it's hard to give it up. But there's also, as I said earlier, and I write about in my blog, this fascination with the idea that it's kind of magical that you can go through this period and be transformed. And on your dullest of days, your most frustrating of days, when you let your mind wander to what else could you be doing, you kind of enjoy the fantasy. No, it's like Game of Thrones. You just wander your way through.
Or for those of us who are actually in the senior citizen category, maybe we would use Walter Mitty as our metaphor. So do we know how common this experience is for all types of people? How much privilege is there to the idea or experience of a midlife crisis?
All right. Again, you've hit the nail right on the head, John. It's a very privileged concept. It's also male privileged in that its origins came from highly select group of men who wanted to validate their own experiences. This was Daniel Levinson at Yale. And that was a case of extreme white privilege. The people who can afford that red sports car, they are living in a certain social class. And even the people who are able to kind of, people with a college education, we know, tend to be more likely to sort of, not always, but think philosophically. And then you have to be able to afford that. Whatever your social class or your education, you can't afford to get away and live out this fantasy that you're going to be left out.
A related concept to a midlife crisis is the idea of the U-shaped life satisfaction. First, break down what that means.
Yes. So several economists have been asking people around, millions of people all around the world, about their happiness levels. It was part of a larger attempt to kind of map the happiest country. You probably hear every year they'll say Finland is the happiest country, or Iceland. So when they done that, they actually had people's ages. And so they said, oh, well, we can see there's this dip in happiness levels. And that dip consists of this. They asked people, how happy are you on a scale of 1 to 10, or 0 to 10? So that's it. That's your number. That goes in. That gets thrown into the statistics along with your age. Now, the actual range of scores, when you look at the U looks very impressive, but when you look at the scale, it's something like 7.2 to 7.4, maybe, something of that nature. Because there are millions of people providing that happiness rating, it looks significant, but the meaning of it is very tiny.
How much does our happiness dip during middle life? I mean, it's not hard to imagine, you notice that first gray hair. Maybe you notice that you've lost a step as an athlete, or you're starting to have some more aches and pains, that kind of thing. You notice your body is getting older, and you start maybe trying to recapture your youth. Is that what's going on here? How much does our happiness dip during middle life?
Okay, well, the answer is not very much. And the study that I cited in my most recent blog on this, Do We Really Need a New Term to Tell Midlifers How to Feel? Okay, so that study was done by a Clark University psychologist in the field of adult development. And he found that people were pretty happy. But it depends how you ask the question. Okay, are you happy at this very moment? Maybe not. Are you satisfied with your life? Well, actually, yes. So it all depends on the way that question is worded. In my own research, I've looked at identity and what you talked about, you know, the first gray hair, some little aches and pains. Those are triggers for identity kind of reevaluation, perhaps. Not to everybody, but to some people. And you deal with this change, you deal with the next change. It's like a bunch of different thresholds that you know, life throws at you, or that you have to walk over through life, not just middle years. Mm-hmm. So when these changes occur, you approach it, you work on it, eventually you integrate it into your sense of self, and you move on. The next thing happens. So every one of those little kind of assaults on your identity, you can cope with one at a time.
We often talk about generations as having characteristics or age groups sharing experiences, but is it irresponsible to generalize this broadly?
Absolutely. And we talk about millennials, and you know they're the latest victims of generation bashing and or generation bad mouthing, and I think that that's so unfortunate. But the same thing happened with the Gen Xers, and of course the much maligned baby boomers. But you cannot call everybody in a generation the same. And the study I just looked at on perfectionism in millennials, they were actually quite perfectionistic. But not everybody, and they're no more perfectionistic, maybe a tiny bit, than their predecessors. So there's so much individual variation, but if you lump everybody into a generational term, it's easier. You know, it's less work, and then you can lump them all into this category and deal with them the same way.
Well, and every generation, when they reach a certain age, thinks kids are taking the world right straight off the edge of the cliff. And it's what I refer to as get off my lawnism.
Yes, absolutely. But that also, I think, is an exaggeration, because I think the majority of people, as much as they'd like to complain, they're not complaining about everybody. And they're also, it's just maybe a kind of a fun thing to do, sound like you're like everybody else, we like to complain. But I think most people have faith in the coming generations, and that's a really important part of psychological development, is to feel that the generations coming after you will be able to carry on not destroy the world.
Yeah, the idea of struggling during middle life, having that midlife crisis, is well established in the culture. But yeah. Those outside the category of middle age project these ideas on their group. Do they? Is that something we just kind of made up?
I don't think most people really think about it that much. In reality, you'll hear somebody say, "Oh, I'm having my midlife crisis," and it's a joke. And that's really what it's come down to, is a very trivialized, ridiculous characterization of important life changes that do occur, but they don't occur in this cartoonish fashion.
So would you agree that we ought to just appreciate whatever stage of life we're in and move on?
Of course I do. I mean, that's what else can you do? You can mourn the past, but it's really not going to get you anywhere. You can learn from the past. You can enjoy delving into the past. Mm-hmm. But we need to keep moving along and looking at not just a future orientation, but pull all together your past, your present, your future into kind of one view of yourself is changing over time.
Yeah, yesterday is history, tomorrow a mystery, today is a gift. That's why we call it the present. Thank you for joining us, Susan. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, John. I enjoyed it as well. Take care.
Susan Krause-Whitborn is Professor Emerita of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She is the author of the Psychology Today blog Fulfillment at Any Age, and has conducted research in the area of personality and aging. This is The Morning Show. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.